declaring an effective date.
Yeah.
Okay, Senator Brown, we now have a quorum. We're on Senate Bill 639, and Senator Hamby has moved that we amend the relating clause saying declaring an effective date, and then we'd add at the end of the bill a Section 8, which would say the effective date of this 1983 Act shall be January 1, 1984. Is there discussion of that amendment? Senator Hamby, what is the need of that amendment?
The reason being that the reality of the situation is most judges will receive their updated materials and be informed of the Act by January 1 of 1984. And secondly, the Commission on Aging, United Seniors, Association of Retarded Citizens, and the Mental Health Division can all get their volunteer forces geared up and ready to respond.
Okay.
And of course,
is there further discussion of Senator Hamby's amendment as to effective date? If not, is there any objection to that motion? If not, it is adopted. Now, we have already moved the hand-engrossed amendments dated 5383, Council?
Yes, you have.
We've already adopted them. We adopted those last session. Have you had an opportunity to look through those?
I did. Now? I went over them with Ms. Rogers.
Do you see any problems in them as to form?
No. They've been form and style by Legislative Council already. And I've gone over them with Terry as to substance and rationale for some of the changes.
Okay. Is there a motion then to send this bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
I so move.
Senator Hamby so moves. Discussion. Are you ready for a roll call?
Question.
Please call a roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Cohen? Fry?
Aye.
Gardner? Hamby?
Aye.
Henderson?
Aye.
And Wire?
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Hamby, your name is first as a sponsor. Would you like to carry this?
I'd be pleased, uh-huh.
Okay, Senator Hamby will carry that bill.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I was absent in a Ways and Means meeting that first hour and a half of our afternoon. I'm sorry I couldn't be here.
Well, Senator Brown is excused then. He's in Ways and Means.
I think we called and but it might not have gotten through. I was in Ways and Means from 3 to 4:30.
Okay. Senate Bill 202.
Why don't we do
707, is that quicker?
Yeah.
Okay, Senate Bill 707. Council says that's quicker. As I recall, that bill's ready to go. Has anyone heard anything contrary to the seeming agreement that we had when we had the original hearing on that? Council, do you wish to comment? Senator Fry.
Let's see.
Well, I'm looking for the bill here. Is it in my bill? Here we go. Council, do you want to comment briefly on, refresh our memories on that?
Well, this is the bill that Gretchen Miller, who's an attorney from Eugene, proposed. That would make a change in the joint tenancy statute. This statute is an 1862 statute, and the way it was written, it did sound as if joint tenancy was abolished, and people who read it themselves had a difficult time figuring out exactly what the law was about joint tenancy. She had suggested an amendment that would make it clear that common law joint tenancy was abolished, and adding in the language that every conveyance would be a tenancy in common, and unless it's expressly declared that they take as joint tenants with right of survivorship or as tenants in common in the life estate with cross contingent remainders in the fee simple. The necessity of it is that the Supreme Court has often struggled to find survivorship in the more complicated ways like tenants in common in the life estate. This would make it clear that this is what the law has been intended to be, but was difficult to perceive from the statute.
There were no critical, as I recall, everyone seemed to feel comfortable with Gretchen Miller's rationale at that time, but has anyone come up with any concerns or heard from any lawyers or constituents with regard to this? Or?
No, seven. I think we're on 707.
707, yes.
I'm reading those with fixed up.
I guess really the problem here, Mr. Chairman, is that the court has interpreted the language one way, and a possible a layman reading it could construe it another way. And she's basically making the language fit the court interpretation. Is that a fair statement, counsel?
Yes.
So it's not new law. It's just clear law.
Doesn't change the case law.
Doesn't change the case.
It just puts it in the statute.
It codifies the judicial interpretation.
Would one of the Lane County senators on the committee like to move this bill to the floor then?
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendrickson moves Senate Bill 707 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Well, I'll vote for it. I just don't think it's necessary. That's the law in Oregon. So I'll support it.
Okay. Further discussion. Please call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Wired?
Aye. Motion carried. Now, Senate Bill 200 was going to be extremely quick because it was a measure that had been brought through the bar, and there was no opposing testimony on it. It would create initiative and referendum procedures for submitting questions to vote a full bar membership. I would have thought that somebody, I think 5 years ago, there would have been some young lawyers here opposing this, but there weren't any. And nobody has contacted me saying they think it's a bad idea. It would allow members who didn't like what the Board of Bar got, what was done at a convention, to refer or to initiate other legislation for the bar. But now, it doesn't seem to have anybody opposing it that I've heard about. Has anybody else heard about anybody opposing it?
Yeah, I don't know how widely, you know, people are, how widely known it is among the lawyers. But
it's circulated.
It was circulated what?
I circulated and contacted people in Portland about it, and there hasn't been any opposition to it in our project.
Glenn Whalen's in favor of it, isn't he? Vote by mail provisions.
Then it came to my attention just very recently that the bar, that another issue has come up about residency requirements as to being a member of the bar due to a recent court decision, which has raised a question about it. And I guess if the members want to consider that, we ought to, attaching that to this bill, we ought to put that over because of the problems we have with members having other appointments. I think we'd have to take some testimony on that.
Is that something we've got to...
Looks like it's more to... Then it's also changing this moral turpitude thing.
Yes.
Too.
Yes.
I never... I guess that's the big issue. What is moral turpitude? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is that the 510 Amendment?
Yes.
This is submitted by the bar.
Tell me to explain all this happened.
Yes, counsel.
The printed amendment to Senate Bill 200 comes to us actually, it's language from the bar. It was actually proposed by the Supreme Court. It's the result of a decision by the District Court Magistrate in Portland, Juba, in a case called Halkides, which was two men from California who wanted to be admitted to practice in Oregon after they passed the bar. They were turned down because they weren't residents of the state, which is what 9.220 requires. Judge Juba said that these people sued the bar, the Supreme Court, and the Board of Bar Examiners. Judge Juba said that particular provision was an unconstitutional violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And as a result of that, we got a letter from Judge Jones saying that the position of the Supreme Court was that since the U.S. District Court had declared it unconstitutional, that we should remove it from the statute. The best I've read the Halkidy's opinion, it was not appealed. The cases, my best information this afternoon was that there are cases going both ways on this particular topic. There are three district court cases that have said it is a violation of the Privileges and Immunities Clause and two district court cases that say it is not. I haven't been able to read the cases, so I don't know if the reasoning is the same.
Do we have any Ninth Circuit court cases on that point at all?
No. This Juba's was the first in this circuit. There, the district courts in New Hampshire, South Dakota, Alabama have said that it is... the footnote in the opinion says that it was successfully challenged under the Privileges and Immunities Clause in those states. Two other district courts, Wisconsin and Maryland, upheld their residency requirements. Alaska has struck down its residency requirements in its state courts, and I would suspect with Alaska's constitution that it might well be based on Alaska's own constitution. So, on the one hand, if the district court has said that that provision is not enforceable in our statute, that's an argument for taking it out. On the other hand, I wonder the correctness of that. It is the final word. It hasn't been appealed.
I was just wondering, you know, we've got that other bill to take away all the unconstitutional portions of our statutes. If we didn't want to do it today with this one, maybe we could add that one into that. Don't we have that?
That's the
omnibus
bill.
No, that abortion one's separate, but
there's a criminal repeal.
There's another one that's got other unconstitutional. That's just criminal matters?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
that's like loitering in some of the subsections in harassment. So.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you from my point of view. Now, first, is the bar recommending this?
Yeah.
The bar is recommending it.
They're here. They testify if you want to hear them.
Judge Jones says,
well, why don't we open up and let them testify?
Well, I'll just tell you that my reaction is that it just seems like every time the federal government says jump, why some folks on the state level are saying how high. And I just think that there's good reasons to require lawyers to be residents of the state in which they're licensed to practice. I don't want to see the law change. That's the way I look at the thing. I'd just as soon stick with it. Let the Ninth Circuit tell us what's wrong with it.
Mr. Chairman,
we've got a split here. One member thinks we should hear from the bar. Senator Brown.
Of course, you can. May states where while you may have needed to be a resident at the time of admission, then you can drop your residency and still retain your bar membership. So it's not something that is necessary to membership.
But this was an applicant.
But you can't practice law in Oregon unless you're a resident or you've got a resident that you're joined with.
Not anymore.
In the prosecution
case. I can practice
under.
Excuse me. Go ahead. I'm practicing in California because I'm a member there, but I'm not a resident because I'm a member. So it's.
Well, maybe I'm wrong on that. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're not.
Why don't we let
Diana? It's just a matter of interpretation.
I see, all right.
Diana Godwin.
That's my feeling, anyway.
But while she's coming up, under Juba's ruling, is it Juba?
Yes.
Under Juba's ruling right now, the bar can't keep somebody who's not a resident from applying.
Yeah, that's they got an injunction against the bar?
That's correct. Diana Godwin for the Oregon State Bar. I want to correct a few impressions about these amendments submitted by the Bar Association. We submitted these and drafted these as a courtesy, basically. The Board of Bar Governors didn't have a particular position on this. When Judge Jones of the Supreme Court sent his letter to both Chairman Wires and Chairman Myers of the House Judiciary Committee requesting that 9.220 be amended to delete the residency requirement consistent with the decision in the Halkidy's case, it fell to the bar to take some initiative on this. Neither committee wanted to introduce a new bill to address this. The only bill we had pending in either this committee or the House Judiciary Committee, which had an appropriate relating clause, was Senate Bill 200. I asked the Public Affairs Committee of the Board of Bar Governors their position on using this bill to accommodate the Supreme Court's request They agreed to that, and as a courtesy matter, I drafted the amendment. This was not done, this deletion of the residency requirement, however, was not done at the initiative of the Board of Bar Governors.
Okay.
While I was drafting the amendment, I did just go ahead and clean up the language in subsection B of section 2 of 9.220 to reform the definition of good moral character, because the way it was written, good moral character was defined exactly the wrong way, that in fact it defined the lack of good moral character. And we had noticed that at the very end of the Sunset hearing process.
A lot of bad characters demanding admission.
Exactly. So we noticed that, and somebody said, we've got to catch that next session, that in fact good moral character is defined exactly in terms of bad moral character. So I thought, well, as long as I was in the statute, I'd go ahead and clean that up. And I worked with George Reamer, our lawyer for the Bar Association, on that amendment. Addressing Senator Frey's question about whether or not an attorney who is already an active member of the Oregon State Bar, having been admitted during the time they were a resident, can move out of state and continue to practice law, Supreme Court Rule 8.05 currently addresses that issue and requires a member of the Oregon State Bar who does not maintain an office in Oregon to associate counsel in Oregon. However, that rule is currently the subject of a separate lawsuit in what's called the Braflate case, or Braflate, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, B-R-A-A-F-L-A-D-T case. That involves the lawyers in Northern California who wish to come in and, I believe, have an office in either Ashland or Maryland, in Medford or Ashland. That's pending right now, and they're not sure what the outcome of that one's going to be. But as far as whether or not residency will continue to be required for admission to the bar, my understanding is that it will not, regardless of whether or not we change this statute. The Supreme Court made the decision on March 29th of this year not to appeal the decision of Magistrate Juba in the Halkidis case, and therefore their directive to the Board of Bar Examiners is to not require admission, or not require residency's condition of admission to the bar. So that is gone at this point. So our
role... You mean
role,
the legislature couldn't make a decision contrary to that?
Well, I haven't researched powers. That. Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Well, doesn't the Supreme Court control the admission?
Well, it does, but...
We could have a nice constitutional challenge.
Yeah, we could get ourselves into a constitutional thicket.
We've got an awful lot of statute having to do with admission to the bar.
I haven't even made a copy for myself yet.
Maybe we better... confer with our law books and put this bill back on for another time.
Well, if the rest of the committee feels that it's good, go ahead and send it out. I'm going to vote no on it, but I don't want to. Yeah.
We don't want to hold up Senate Bill 200 either over this issue. We drafted these amendments, as I said, as a courtesy matter, and allowed our bill to be used if the committee wished to accommodate the Supreme Court's request.
Well, if the Ninth Circuit overrules...
they're not going to appeal it, though.
So there's no appeal. It's dead.
But another
Mr.
case
Chair,
might
that's,
come up.
Well, my feeling is that if the practice is going to be, because the Supreme Court is not going to require residency, it seems like we're misleading people to have that in the statute. That's the concern I have. So I don't have any objection, nor... Do
I
have any policy?
I guess that's right, and I don't know whether we need to worry about whether the Supreme Court can say one thing if the legislature wants to say something else. But anyway, go ahead and send it out. My mind's made up. I'm going to vote no, but it's no big moment to me. I don't think I need any more time. I guess I'm the only one here, Mr. Chairman, that feels that way, so...
Well, I'm not sure how I feel. That's part of the reason I was making suggestions about taking more time. I don't have my mind made up, and I didn't hear about this idea until very recently, so I haven't had much time to think about it. The two ideas are rather quite different ones. I don't think if I were opposed to this, I would object that these ideas were too different to be in the same bill. But that concerns me a little. I don't know that anybody would do that, but this is... two mice and one snake.
I just wonder on this other part that they haven't had people that they've tried to get out for moral turpitude to claim they don't have any statutory authority. It looks like moral turpitude is a requirement for admission to the bar.
Yeah.
It has been.
Maybe people who get kicked out for moral turpitude aren't very good statutory constructionists.
Or just readers. Ordinary plain readers.
Well, let's see.
I guess, you know, if you feel uncomfortable, hold it over. I don't think it's any big deal. But,
why don't we hold it over and do a little more thinking about it? I don't feel comfortable getting out and backing a floor fight on this without thinking more about it.
I just think the general trend of residency is to strike down residency requirements, not just in this area, but all over the place.
I think this is going to raise questions on the floor. There are probably a bunch of lawyers like myself who hadn't heard about the court case. And when this comes out on the floor and it's repealing the residency requirement, it's going to take a lot of explaining on the floor. I guess maybe we could call on the bar lobbyists as a courtesy to go around and explain it to each member before the floor debate. Then they're nodding their head. Do you think we ought to, even though you disagree, move ahead with it so that we don't hold up 200?
No, I don't have any feelings at all.
You're
I think if anybody else has any reservations, it ought to be held up. But if you feel like...
I think we better talk to the other two members. A couple of days won't kill us. Does anybody mind that? If you do, I don't feel strong about that either. Okay. Now, one more bill we might have time to deal with here is Senate Bill 202. This bill has a controversial aspect in it where the independent telephone companies have raised some concerns and questions. A representative of service stations for the oil companies mentioned to me just a few moments ago that there might be an unintended effect in the bill as to hazards around service stations of the ordinary garden variety. I have an interest in the bill, which is on this amendments dated 5-9-83, that if you go to the last... page of those. Mine isn't stapled on.
Yeah, it's a loose page.
It's a loose page.
It's page 5.
It's page 5. In the middle, you see some statutory language that's been been highlighted.
Yeah.
This would delete the language that's bracketed there in sub 3 and would put in a new sub 3. Sub 3 now says that the has the effect of virtually allowing the Public Utility Commissioner to be removed by the governor for any cause, any reason, and has him serving basically at the pleasure of the governor. And I would propose that we change that to say within 90 days of taking office, the governor may remove the commissioner without cause. This is an idea I mentioned to the committee in concept earlier. After the first 90 days of the governor's term, the commissioner may be removed only for cause following a public hearing and appeal. And this would have the effect of saying that if there's a change after a new governor takes office, if they want to change the Public Utility Commissioner, they can do that, just to put a new person in, if they do it within 90 days after they take office. They remove them within 90 days after taking office.
Could I ask a question?
And put somebody else in. And if they do that, then after that, they have to give them a hearing and so forth. Or any public utility commissioner that's removed for any other reason. Senator Hendrickson.
How does it work now? Do they have a term of office, or are they they serve totally at the pleasure, so each new governor appoints a new one? Is that how it works now?
They have a 4-year term of office. They aren't necessarily changed by a new governor.
So their terms do not run the same terms as the governor does?
No.
In fact, it was halfway through about.
We just
So in some ways, this would give them less protection than they have now, then? Or
this would... No, this would give them more protection, because the governor can, under current law that we'd be taking out, it says the governor may at any time remove the commissioner for any cause deemed by him sufficient.
And that could include being a new... So they serve at the pleasure.
Right.
Cosmetic terms.
And I want to make it where they serve, except the governor can change when a new governor takes office, or for that matter, I guess if a governor is reelected, when they take office, they could make a change. Otherwise, they could only be removed for cause, and they'd have a right to a hearing.
Well, that's pretty a substantial philosophical change, isn't it?
This gives the Public Utility Commissioner something more approaching what I think the public thinks a commissioner has, which is some independence.
It could work the other way, though, couldn't it?
How's that?
Well, the commissioner could be acting inconsistent with the public interest. At least the governor may think that he's doing so.
Yes, if the Public Utility Commissioner was operating within the rule, his proper authority and the rules that existed and so on, and he was behaving in a way that the governor didn't like. Mm-hmm. So, as you say, the other way, yeah. A governor could appoint somebody that was high-minded and then find that they had become overly partial toward an interest.
Yeah.
Then they wouldn't be able to remove them for that.
Yeah. That's really serious change in the approach, isn't it?
After 90 days, they're locked in.
Well, but it seems to me that, I mean, suppose that, you know, the governor really does want to get rid of this commissioner, something fierce, because he's got a different philosophy about things, or he's developed a new and different philosophy, but yet actually he wouldn't be able to establish, you know, legal cause or just cause, but there is that confrontation going on there. This would, of course, permit a public utility commissioner to continue to serve, even though that public utility commissioner was at odds with the governor on a lot of things, as long as he's not acting.
That's right.
Yeah.
Of course, the public utility commissioner's budget would still have to go through the budget process and so forth. But the reason I put this in is there's been a lot of arguing around about whether we ought to have an elected public utility commissioner and so forth. That bill, as I understand, my understanding is that bill's dead for this session. But I had this idea before it was dead. I'm not doing this as a kind of a compromise or backup or something. It seems to me this is a less politicized way of trying to protect the public utility commissioner from being told by the governor to do certain things. It depoliticizes somewhat the public utility commissioner.
I agree, it does do that. And so the policy question is that what we want? Do we want a public utility commissioner who really is not carrying out what the governor thinks ought to be done?
Yeah, which is what I think the public thinks. I think the public thinks that if we were going to continue what we have, we ought to call them something like some kind of rates department of the governor, of the executive branch, so the public would see that they are acting an extension of the governor. I think the word commission is a word that is used to imply that there's independence in decision making.
Well, it may be that some of the public has a misconception of what role a public utility commissioner is going to play, but in fact, at least I think, in fact, the public utility commissioner really speaks for the governor's policies, and that's either good or bad. That's the policy question we have to make. It's whether we want him to continue to be beholden to the governor, or do we want to change it so that that he doesn't have to be and still stay in office.
Well, yeah, have slight independence. The governor could still, through the budget process, have a tremendous effect on the operation. And but that's the question. It just last session, one of the things that got me interested in this was the last session we had a roaring debate where a bunch of people thought that the public utility commissioner had reversed his course about 180 degrees on a major decision that had been hotly debated and a rule was being drafted and so on. And there was a lot of indignant allegations that the governor might have directed the Public Utility Commissioner to reverse directions. And I think that showed me that indeed there is a tremendous public misperception of what the Public Utility Commissioner is doing. I agree with you that they are indeed reflecting the governor's direction, philosophy, and approach.
Do you think
that these people were shocked and appalled that the governor might have made a contact with the Public Utility Commissioner, which changed directions?
Mm-hmm. Do you think something like this, if it passed the legislature, would have a realistic chance of getting by a governor's veto?
Well, I don't know, but so many, that question can be asked about so many bills. It seems to me if you think it's a bad idea, you shouldn't be for it, but if you think it is, you ought to. It's certainly a lot less politicized than something like an elected PUC. I think it's a good idea myself. I think when the governor appoints somebody, there is a lot of hearings going on over there and a lot of apparent due process going on, and to have a governor be able to reach into that and shift it around in a way that the Public Utility Commissioner doesn't agree with, which would be the only time you'd have any problem with this. There's nothing in this that keeps the Public Utility Commissioner and the governor from meeting every day. It'd just be if the Public Utility Commissioner wanted to say, hey, we've gone through all these procedures and I want to do it this way.
Chairman.
Senator Brown.
This basically